Bon, ben voilà, donc j'ai réussi à mettre mon PowerPoint. Je crois que je peux postuler pour le concours du PowerPoint le plus moche du colloque. Mais bon, voilà, désolé. Dans les années 1920-1930, les sœurs Nardal vivent en France hexagonale à Paris. Elles sont arrivées comme étudiantes. Elles tiennent un salon qui devient le creuset de la négritude. Et elles développent, avec cette expérience migratoire, une conscience aiguë des problèmes liés à la condition noire et au fait d'être une femme noire en France. Je renvoie pour cela aux travaux de Jennifer Boitin sur les sœurs Nardal. Elles viennent plutôt de la bourgeoisie, mais en arrivant en France hexagonale, elles prennent conscience de toute une série de problèmes. 40 ans plus tard, le profil des femmes antillaises et réunionnaises qui arrivent en France hexagonale est bien différent. Elles viennent de milieux plus populaires. Peut-on dire que cette migration se marque aussi par une prise de conscience, par un engagement qui pourrait ressembler à celui qui devient celui des sœurs Nardal? Alors, moi, j'ai travaillé spécifiquement sur le BUMIDOM, le Bureau des Migrations d'Outre-mer. Je vais rappeler ce que c'est parce que tout le monde ne connaît pas forcément. C'est un organisme, une société d'État qui a existé entre 1963 et 1982 et qui avait pour objectif d'organiser la migration en France hexagonale d'une partie de la jeunesse des départements d'outre-mer. Réunion, Guadeloupe, Martinique et Guyane. Les objectifs de ce BUMIDOM, de cet organisme d'État, c'était d'une part d'essayer de trouver une solution très rapide, urgente, à la crise sociale qui était dans les DOM, et qui est une crise sociale qui se traduisait aussi par des volontés d'indépendance qui ne plaisaient pas du tout au gouvernement français. Et puis également de fournir une main-d'œuvre bon marché en France hexagonale, et avec l'espoir que cette main-d'œuvre soit docile. Ça a concerné 200 000 personnes qui ont migré en 20 ans, et il faut ajouter à ça des personnes qui sont venues par leurs propres moyens, qui ne sont pas venues avec l'aide du BUMIDOM, mais qui sont venues par eux-mêmes. Alors, c'est une migration importante avec cette spécificité d'une migration encadrée par l'État, et cette spécificité aussi qu'il s'agit de citoyens français. Donc de citoyens français, mais qui connaissent un traitement spécifique et des formes de racialisation quand ils arrivent en France hexagonale. Donc c'est un cas intéressant, en effet, pour réfléchir sur le post-colonialisme, sur le post-impérialisme français. Alors, ce qui est intéressant, vous voyez là la courbe des migrations avec la provenance selon les années des migrants. Ce qui est intéressant par rapport à cette migration, par rapport à d'autres migrations, c'est que c'est une migration qui rassemble un nombre important de femmes, un tiers de femmes à peu près, qui sont venues seules ou qui sont venues par le regroupement familial en tant que fiancées, épouses, sœurs, mères ou filles. Donc souvent les migrations sont présentées, migrations de travail en tout cas, sont souvent des migrations plutôt masculines. Or là on voit donc cette proportion de femmes vraiment importante. Ce sont des femmes souvent très jeunes, parfois mineures. Donc, je vous rappelle qu'à l'époque la minorité, pendant une partie de la période en tout cas que j'étudie, la minorité est à 21 ans. Je vous renvoie aux travaux de Stéphanie Condon. Sur les migrations, sur travail et genre dans l'histoire des migrations antillaises, notamment, elle montre que 45% des femmes antillaises qui ont migré travaillaient dans des emplois de service et parmi elles 12% comme domestiques. En effet, ces migrations qui arrivent avec le BUMIDOM, ces migrations de femmes avec le BUMIDOM, il y a une dimension très genrée dans cette migration, avec la volonté de donner des métiers spécifiques aux hommes et aux femmes. Donc les hommes sont souvent envoyés dans des centres de formation qui les amènent vers des métiers de l'industrie, et les femmes plutôt vers des métiers de service. Avec des contraintes assez fortes. Je vous donne un exemple en fait de la lettre que ces migrantes étaient obligées de signer si elles voulaient se faire payer le voyage par le Mumidom. Informé que j'étais dirigé sur le centre de Crouy-sur-Ourcq dans la spécialité gens de maison et ne pourrais en aucun cas demander à l'arrivée en métropole de changer de spécialité. Je reconnais également vouloir accepter à ma sortie du centre un emploi de gens de maison et cela quel que soit les lieux d'emploi qui me seraient proposés. Ramener son domicile dans son département d'origine constitue de son fait une rupture du contrat passé avec le Bumidom. Donc vous voyez, dans cette dimension contraignante, le fait d'être obligé d'accepter un type d'emploi et le fait aussi d'être obligé d'accepter une localisation géographique. Alors, il a été question de Crouy-sur-Ourcq. De quoi s'agit-il ? Eh bien, il s'agit d'un centre de formation, donc spécifiquement féminin, dans lequel les migrantes étaient envoyées pour quelques semaines ou quelques mois, et dans lesquelles elles étaient soumises à des apprentissages spécifiques, qui étaient tâches ménagères, cuisine, pour en faire en fait des domestiques que des familles bourgeoises de France hexagonale venaient chercher dans le centre. Souvent des familles parisiennes, mais pas seulement. Donc on voit des photos, ça c'est des photos qui sont produites par le Bumidom, dans lequel on voit les tâches qui sont assignées à ces femmes et également donc les conditions dans lesquelles elles dorment, donc sous forme de dortoir. Alors, on voit bien que l'assignation est très forte hein, quand on lit ces archives. On a cependant, en tant qu'historien, un moyen d'essayer de voir comment ces femmes ont réagi à ces assignations. Et notamment, on a les dossiers individuels des migrantes. Il y en a 10% qui ont été conservés, enfin 10% sur l'ensemble des migrants, hommes et femmes compris. Mais parmi ceux-là, donc il y a pas mal de migrantes. Ça permet en fait d'avoir indirectement ou directement la voix de ces migrantes, à travers des lettres qu'elles ont pu faire, à travers des rapports qui sont faits sur elles. Donc voilà, c'est des sources qu'il faut prendre avec précaution, mais qui permettent quand même de comprendre un certain nombre de choses. Alors, dès les années 1960, il y a eu des oppositions et des résistances à cette politique migratoire. Je renvoie aux travaux de Myriam Paris sur notamment l'Union des femmes de la Réunion. Également aux travaux qui ont été énoncés tout à l'heure de Théophile Copé et Ingrid Château. J'ai trouvé ça hyper intéressant de voir comment il pouvait y avoir des mouvements de femmes noires qui se mettaient en place dans les années 70. Là, moi, ce sur quoi je vais vous parler, c'est des femmes qui n'acceptent pas les assignations, qui d'une certaine manière résistent, mais ce ne sont pas des résistances qui sont directement politiques, qui ne s'inscrivent pas directement dans une affirmation de féminisme noir, mais plutôt dans une volonté donc d'échapper aux assignations. Avec une arme pour ces femmes, un élément important, c'est leur statut de citoyenne, qui fait que même si le Bumidom a des exigences par rapport à elles, finalement, c'est une institution assez faible, parce qu'une fois qu'il leur a payé le voyage, qu'elles sont installées en France hexagonale, il peut difficilement les contraindre. Elles sont citoyennes françaises, il peut pas les expulser, il peut pas les punir. Donc voilà. Donc ça permet quand même d'avoir une gamme diverse de résistances métapolitiques affirmées ou détournées. Alors, un dernier élément quand même sur cette migration avant de passer à ces résistances, cette volonté de partir, elle peut être adossée chez certaines de ces femmes quand même à une volonté d'émancipation. J'ai eu un entretien par exemple avec une femme qui était devenue domestique et qui disait que elle voulait partir de la Réunion parce que l'insularité lui pesait, le fait d'être dans sa famille, sous le regard de sa famille, de ses proches, etc., de son village, etc., ça lui pesait. Pour elle, le fait même de partir en France hexagonale était un moyen de changer sa destinée. Si on regarde les manières dans le détail qu'ont les femmes d'échapper aux assignations, on se rend compte qu'il y a pas mal de stratégies qui leur permettent de ne pas se résigner au sort de l'institution. Je vous donne un exemple. MB, qui est employée comme femme, comme domestique, par exemple, on a une lettre d'une employeuse qui n'est pas contente, qui dit « MB, qui est employée chez moi depuis le 25 septembre, m'a annoncé sa décision de me quitter pour rentrer chez un autre employeur. Elle avait, disait-elle, deux places que lui proposait le Bumidome par l'intermédiaire d'un de ses employés, avec lequel elle est amie. Son camarade l'ayant persuadée que son salaire était dérisoire, elle ne veut plus s'en contenter, loin de là. Donc on voit bien hein, que la femme qui écrit est complètement choquée. Hein, elle dit « oui, je la considérais presque comme une membre de la famille, elle était traitée avec affection, son travail n'était pas accablant ». Et voilà, donc elle voit comme une ingratitude le fait que cette femme, tout simplement, change d'employeur parce qu'elle était payée 300 francs par mois. Autre possibilité, on a autre exemple, pardon, une femme qui téléphone en disant que une jeune fille est partie avec ses valises sans prévenir son employeur. Encore un autre exemple. Une femme qui dit « Elle s'est présentée chez Madame F, elle y a couché, semblait très contente, devait revenir chercher ses bagages, est venue les prendre, m'a dit être très contente d'être embauchée chez une dame seule, mais n'est jamais retournée chez Madame F, qui s'est aperçue qu'elle avait emporté toutes ses affaires de nuit et avait sans doute prémédité de ne pas rentrer. » Donc là aussi, une employeuse qui est choquée. Alors, on a toute une gamme de réactions. On retrouve exit, voice et loyalty, les manières traditionnelles d'échapper à des situations qui sont compliquées. Si on regarde au niveau des statistiques, on se rend compte donc qu'il y a beaucoup de femmes, en effet, qui sont employées de maison et aides ménagères, mais qu'il y en a aussi beaucoup qui sont agents de collectivité ou OS. Travailler dans l'industrie, donc comme ouvrière. Et surtout, on voit entre 75 et 79 que cette part de femmes qui deviennent OS ou qui deviennent agents de collectivité augmente. Alors, celles qui sont employées de maison et aides ménagères aussi, mais on voit bien que se dessinent d'autres destinées. Alors, le fait d'être agent de collectivité, souvent, c'est des femmes qui travaillent dans les hôpitaux. C'est une destinée auquel le Bumidome avait pensé pour ces femmes, mais il n'empêche que c'est quand même un moyen de ne pas être domestique. Quant à celles qui deviennent ouvrières, ça c'est vraiment quelque chose qui n'était pas prévu. Et donc là, on peut penser que ces femmes qui vraiment viennent de milieux très populaires, il y a de nombreuses fiches où on voit qu'elles habitent dans des familles très nombreuses, dans des maisons en tôle, sans eau, sans électricité. Donc ça correspond bien sûr à la situation sociale qu'il peut y avoir dans les DOM à cette époque-là. Mais ça veut dire aussi que c'est des femmes qui viennent de milieux très populaires. Pour autant, elles ne sont pas dépourvues de ressources quand elles arrivent en France hexagonale pour ne pas se résigner à devenir domestiques et pour changer. Donc on voit bien qu'elles peuvent partir en catimini, qu'elles peuvent parfois faire jouer la concurrence entre les employeurs, puisque il n'y a pas beaucoup de femmes en France hexagonale à cette époque-là qui veulent être domestiques. Donc celles qui le sont peuvent essayer de faire valoir d'essayer de défendre leurs intérêts. Également, autre possibilité qui n'est pas prévue par le Bumidome, celle du retour au pays. Et même des allers-retours. Ça, c'est encore moins prévu par le Bumidome. Et donc là, on retrouve loyalty avec cette femme qui écrit « J'ai l'honneur de votre haute bienveillance de bien vouloir avoir l'amabilité de chercher un poste de travail comme aide-soignante pour moi dans une de ces cliniques de Paris. Voyez-vous, je me suis décidé de vous écrire aujourd'hui parce que je suis décidé de venir travailler à Paris. D'ailleurs, je connais bien Paris et la majeure partie de la France. J'ai déjà fait 5 ans sans revenir dans notre chère petite île. Eh bien voilà, comme maintenant j'ai déjà aidé pas mal mes parents depuis que je suis de retour depuis bientôt 4 ans, mais vous pouvez pas savoir combien je suis malheureuse et j'en ai marre de rester ici. Si c'est possible à vous de trouver une place pour moi, je serai contente. » Donc une femme qui assume le fait d'avoir choisi de revenir puis de repartir et qui n'hésite pas à redemander une aide au Bumidome. C'est également un dernier moyen d'échapper à ce que demande le Bumidome, c'est de ne pas rembourser les prêts. Le Bumidome accorde des prêts pour le regroupement familial, pour le trousseau, pour la naissance aussi parfois d'enfants ou pour les meubles. Eh bien, le fait de ne pas rembourser le prêt, c'est un moyen de ne pas se conformer à cette autorité. Il y a donc une diversité de pratiques, avec des femmes qui parfois se conforment pour mieux se détourner, avec des stratégies qui vont du contournement à l'opposition franche et nette. Ça dessine des portraits de femmes qui ne se laissent pas faire et ça alimente aussi de l'autre côté un certain nombre de stéréotypes avec Par exemple, certaines de ces femmes dont je vous ai lu les stratégies, sur l'une d'entre elles, on dit que c'est une brave fille, peu intelligente. Sur une autre, on dit qu'elle semble paresseuse ou mal adaptée. Pardon, c'est... J'avais mis mon propre horloge qui est pire que même Fatou Nyang, mais je dépasse juste vraiment d'une phrase. Donc, ce qui apparaît comme des stéréotypes qu'on retrouve dans la racialisation de ces femmes, l'idée de la femme qui vient des DOM qui serait paresseuse, qui serait mal adaptée, qui serait susceptible aussi. On dit parfois que ce sont des femmes qui sont susceptibles. On peut les voir sous un nouveau jour. Si on s'intéresse à ces stratégies-là et voir que finalement c'est l'envers de l'image docile que les dirigeants du Bumidom ont pu vendre aux employeurs ou ont pu développer eux-mêmes. Et que ces stéréotypes, en fait, ce n'est pas... Il faut vraiment pas du tout les prendre au pied de la lettre, mais plutôt les voir d'une certaine manière comme le reflet des stratégies développées par ces femmes pour tracer leur propre voie d'émancipation.
On donne 50 secondes et voici comment on se fait remercier. Non, je rigole. Donc on va écouter maintenant Amatoula pour une communication intitulée « The New Black Morocco, The Complex Life of Sub-Saharan African Christian Martyrs ». Et Amatoula nous vient de Lewis and Clark College.
Everybody, my name is Amatoula Aman and I'm representing Lewis and Clark today, Lewis and Clark College. Although this has been a really great honor for me, this is my first presentation. I'm still in my undergrad, so this is really exciting for me. Yeah, although it's been an honor for y'all to... Thank you. Thank you so much. Yeah, so this has been a blessing, honestly. But it's also been sort of a moral dilemma for me to be invited to an international conference in one of the most beautiful cities in the world to speak to you guys about conversations I had with sub-Saharan African mothers stuck in a state of limbo and continuous systematic abuse has been leaving me with a lot of unease. I want to state that I'm here solely as a microphone for those forced in silence by the state and international institutions solely based on their race, gender, and migration status. I want to let the audience know that I'll be speaking on traumatic experiences, so I won't be hurt if you guys had to step out of the room. So this is a sort of outline of what I'll be speaking on today. So today we'll be speaking on the lives of six women who hailed from Nigeria, Cote d'Ivoire, and Cameroon. I spoke with them and developed friendships during my stay in Fez, Morocco, which happened during my study abroad. To better understand the intersectionalities of being Christian, Black, African, female, and transient in Morocco, first things first, it's being a minority of a minority of a minority of a minority. But to be more specific, we must first contextualize those terms in the Moroccan context. To be Christian in Morocco is to be a part of the Christian Moroccan community that is less than 1% of the total population of Morocco. An Islamic state, it is illegal to convert people to its religions other than Islam in Morocco. It is also against the law for anyone to have a copy of the Holy Bible in Arabic in Morocco. This is to prevent people from trying to convert Muslims to Christianity. Unlike Judaism and Sunni Islam, Christianity is not recognized as a religion in the Moroccan constitution. To understand Blackness and thus Black feminism in Morocco, we must first look at Moroccan history. The enslavement of Black persons have played a role in shaping racial relations in Morocco. The Western notion of Islamic slavery, one that depicts a racial egalitarian society free from prejudice or discrimination, is false. Morocco shared its patterns with, and in fact participated in, the global African diaspora, which is also known as the Mafa. The cultural exchange of racial attitudes endemic to the African diaspora justified slavery, even where such justifications was inconsistent with the tenets of Islam and explicitly expressed in the Quran and Hadith. The enslaved people were of both sexes, young and adults, and the tragic heroine in Moroccan slavery is female. No, we're still here. It's okay. The enslaved black women endured unimaginable burden as domestic servants and concubines. The crucial role of women in many African culture is the notion of double exploitation of women in labor and childbearing. A similar duality existed in Morocco, which defined the preference of women over men for domestic labor and sexual exploitation. This gender preference was the foundation upon which a larger burden rested on females. It was legally and socially established for a male to be entitled to a female sexuality, as well as legally and socially conventional for the children of female slaves to inherit their father's legal status. The interplay of color and social function complicated the racial equation in Moroccan society. Enslaved black women who became concubines of their masters might have used sexual liaisons with their masters to secure better position within a society where gender was hierarchical and patriarchal. Black female slaves were forced to use their sexuality and emotional resources to navigate the harsh realities of slavery and its attendant loss of personal identity and pride to rebuild new identities and enhance their agency in a manner that at times transcended servile conditions, race, and color prejudice. Popular fantasies about black sexuality enforced the perception of black female body as the other. The complexities of concubinage are based on partial liberty. As Morocco never abolished slavery with any decree of royal authority, slavery finished as a consequence of a capitalist system introduced by French colonial occupation of Morocco. So now that you have the background, I'll go more into what's happening now. The migration of sub-Saharan Africans to Europe through Morocco has been an international issue that has captured the attention of people everywhere. The kingdom's 2011 constitution, written and enacted in response to a wave of pro-democracy protests, also known as the Arab Spring, guarantees, quote, foreigners under Moroccan jurisdiction the fundamental freedoms recognized for all in Morocco. With the recent spike of black African migrants in Morocco, which includes asylum seekers and refugees fleeing conflict and oppression within their countries of origin, the Moroccan constitution is being tested. Black African migrants often have difficult time integrating fully to the new location and establishing stable lives. Research has been done before on the transient migrants in Morocco, but most are of the male perspective. The social economic profiles of transient migrants in Morocco have predominantly been from male migrants. The image of a typical transient migrant would be young, single male that is highly mobile. When there is mention of women migrants, they are often described as being under male control during their migratory projects. Female migrants in Morocco have been the focus of research in relation to sexual violence and or trafficking issues. The strong focus on sexual violence and male control in both research and policy making implicitly reinforces an image of female transient in Morocco as victims, with little agency over their decision to migrate or subsequent trajectory in Morocco. In researching migrant women and agency, I hope to shed lights on the many different types of people and migrant lives and how the different lives live. Which brings me to my research question. How have Christian migrant, you got that? Okay. One more. There you go. How have Christian migrant African women inflect their experience in relation to transient race and gender in Morocco? To better answer this question, I went the route of speaking to women in Morocco who are a part of those intersectionalities. In having long discussions with them and a lot of like introspection within myself, both on the paper and what I'm doing and how to even talk to people about this properly, I've broken up their stories and traumas into three stages: leaving, going, and staying. And yeah, you can see these three categories. You can go. Next slide. Okay, leaving. The trauma of leaving begins early, during their decision process to leave home for Europe. As told by one woman, who I'll call Mary, just for her anonymity, after the Civil War broke out in Côte d'Ivoire, Mary's husband, a successful musician at the time, lost work and went to Morocco to find a job to feed their seven children. Well, originally he was trying to go to Europe, but of course he got stuck. Orphaned by the war and unable to sit there whilst her husband works abroad, sending not enough money back to pay for food and school fees, Mary split up her children to different households and joined her husband to beg for money on the streets. At the time I spoke to Mary, it had been 9 months since she last saw her children, and since she's given birth to a healthy baby girl who's yet to see her siblings with no set date in sight. So you see that in leaving, like, many of these women and a lot of their husbands that I've spoken to had great jobs, they were happy, and it wasn't, and I can't speak to other situations, but based on the people I've spoken to, it was forced migration for the most part, and it wasn't their inability or need to like pursue something better just because they wanted to. It was like they were refugees. The next trauma was going. You can continue. Yeah. Other way. Okay. The trauma continues during their journey to what they thought would be Europe, one that involves starving for weeks on end, packed on huge trucks like sardines, and vulnerable to sexual harassment, assault, and rape. Although four out of the six women I spoke with told me their experiences were fine, upon further discussion, their definition of fine would be a trip without being raped. One woman's okay trip involved several people dying by getting thrown off the truck because the trucks were going so fast and the car was so packed that people flew out of the car and was run over and killed by the car following them. Staying, which is very complicated. This trauma, staying in a state where they are unwanted by both the people and the country, is seeped into every action of their lives in Morocco. Unable to go back, not allowed to go forward, all of these women tell the same story of invisibility yet hypervisible. Their only form of income, begging on the street, they tell accounts of being sexually harassed by men wanting them to prostitute, getting spit on by people as they walk down the street, people trying to hit them with their cars, and getting threatened to be killed. Mary, the mother who I mentioned earlier, told me an account of a group of men coming up to her and offering 20,000 euros for her baby girl. I say this all to show you the conditions these women face daily, unwanted, unseen, yet hypervisible. So what do I gave y'all all of this information, a lot of context. What do you do with this? I don't know. That is the reason why I was too scared to even come here. Like, I don't know how to provide institutional revolution. Like, the kind of need, the kind of things that these women need isn't something that the world is built for right now. So yeah, this is a question I lose endless amount of sleep over, always coming back to, I don't know. I can't single-handedly bring back these women, nor the countless other migrants stuck in a similar state of limbo out of poverty. These stories hit close to home because they remind me of my mother and others in my community who immigrated to America from Ethiopia, who have suffered through endless loops of fear, violence, and chaos. The stories of women migrants in Morocco show that the gendered and gendering aspects of migration are not mutually exclusive, but instead interact with each other. Women are actively producing and reproducing their gender roles and identities in order to increase access to social and physical mobility. Particularly for these women, as being a religious minority in an Islamic state, being mothers within a patriarchal and male-dominant spaces, being transients in an increasingly xenophobic Morocco, being Black within the context of Morocco's history and slavery, and the intersectionalities of all four that these women reside in. The end.
Thank you, Aman. And you know that saying, I don't know, is the first step to writing a dissertation, right? Right. And then we'll all remember in 8 years when she started her first job at Yale, Harvard, or here in Paris that she delivered her first talk here. So now we'll give the mic to our next MC, Mukile, for a communication entitled A Womanist Novel in the Soviet Eyes, a case of the Russian translation of Maryam Abbas' So Long a Letter.
Thanks very much. I'm really happy to be here and to be able to share my research. I'm a French speaker, native French speaker, but because I've written this paper in English and I'll speak in English, so apologies. But you can ask me a question in French and I'll answer in French. I've got a corpus of novels written by Francophone African writers, translated into Russian, but I'm only looking into Maryam Abbas novel for this paper. Just a quick introduction. She's a well-known artist, so I'm not going to spend much time on introducing her work. The novel was published in French in 1979, translated into Russian in 1981, and as you know, it's a classic. She's a winner of a Nobel Prize. That's just for a quick introduction of her novel, and I'll quickly go on to the translation scene because as translators, we do not translate without context. So to give you a bit about what was happening at the time. So it's one thing, it's the UN decade for women. So that was a period of 10 years where the UN was promoting women rights. That what was happening globally. In Soviet Russia, because the novel was published in Soviet Russia in the 80s, so in Soviet Russia, particularly, more specifically, one big event was the work of the Soviet Committee for Women. It was led by Tatiana Valentina. For those who don't know her, she's the first woman to be a cosmonaut. She's the first woman cosmonaut. She was leading that association. And there's an American scholar named Kirsty Godsey. She's done lots of work about the Soviet Committee for Women with Third World Women. You know, all the seminars, conferences that were working together to promote women's rights. And also, there's also one significant event happening in Soviet Russia itself. It's the there was a feminist movement called, I don't know if you heard about it, what's called Samizdat. Samizdat is self-published literature because Russia has a long history of censorship. So people used to publish themselves, and my mom led some women to publish for themselves because the men in the dissident movement didn't want to publish women centered issues. So that was also some significant happening when the novel was published in Russia. So we can also link that to the there was kind of a feminist discourse happening at the time as well. So that's for the transition scene. Now I am going to move on and explain the theory I'm going to apply. So as you know, Spivak, she's a big scholar. She has many notions. But the one I am going to apply in my transition data, it's the notion of the disappearance of the woman between two competing discourses. The easy way to understand this notion is to think about a child being torn apart between two divorcing parents. Because Spivak explained that on one hand you have imperialism, on the other hand you have patriarchal traditions, and in between the woman disappear. So I'm going to use that notion and trying to apply it in my transition data. So I'm going to come to that when I show you the examples. That's just a quick summary for the novel. Again, it's a well-known novel. So the novel is about two women having initially a happy marriage, and then one will decide to divorce. That's Aissatou, her husband, and go and become an independent woman. And the other one will, Rahmatullah, will stay in a relationship despite, she I guess maybe a woman is thinking, you know, she could divorce, she's well educated, but she chose, but it was her choice to stay in that relationship, although she could if she wanted to divorce Modou. So now I'm going to move on to the text. So I'll give you the first example. The first example, that's for example. So ST, it's a text de départ. TT, it's text d'arrivée, target text. And CT, just a close translation. So the first example is related to the couple. But here, we're talking about married couple because they were married. So in the first example, je suis de celle qui ne peut se réaliser et s'épanouir que dans le couple. And then I've given you the English, just so you know it in English. And then the Russian translation, that's TT. Я из тех женщин, которые не представляют свою жизнь вне семьи. And then just under the Russian, I'm giving you what the Russian means. So, and then I've highlighted in bold so you can see the translation shifts. So you have in the texte d'arrivée, ST, you have que dans le couple. So this is Rahmatullah explaining to the readers that she doesn't see herself outside the couple. But when it's going into the Russian context, that's que dans le couple, only in the couple, it changes to outside the family. So you can see it's kind of generalizing. And this can be linked to the Marxist discourse because if we go back to the official Marxist discourse and Alexander Kalantay, which was one of the main women in propagating Marxist research, she used to say that women are dependent, are suffering because they are dependent on men and on the capital. And she was the first minister of social affairs, and she did help a lot to get all these divorce laws in Russia, abortion laws. So you can see the thinking of the translator within that particular discourse. So she doesn't really, maybe it must have been unsettling for her to think that you can only be happy in the couple. So I'll give you the next example. Again, this is related to family So the first sentence is, je n'ai jamais conçu le bonheur hors du couple, tout en te comprenant, tout en respectant le choix des femmes libres. I'll let you read the English translation. The Russian version says, я, я понимаю тебя, и сад, я уважаю тех, кто решился жить свободной жизнью, но сама на такую не гожусь. Again, you can see it in bold, the shift. So she's saying, hors du couple. And then the Russian version is again, somewhat generalizing, you know, because the translation has got, that's my own interpretation. It's a society where women are free to divorce, so it's kind of unsettling for her. So she doesn't, she's not translating it that way, sorry. And then the other example I want to give you that relates to education. In the book, in the novel, sorry, there's the young Naboo, little Naboo. She was raised in a traditional way. And this is her. This is Auntie Naboo saying, en vérité, l'instruction d'une femme n'est pas à pousser. Et puis je me demande comment une femme peut gagner sa vie en parlant matin et soir. So, and the Russian version says, во всяком случае, не буду штикать некоторые молот языком с утра до вечера, и за что только им деньги платят. Is there for you in English? It's just completely different. Because in Russia, it's Soviet Russian, I should be precise. It's a society where Russian women, they could be classified among the first who had access to education, you know. So to have that translation in the Soviet context, where you saying to some Soviet girl that you cannot study, again, it is unsettling. So you can see how this is being manipulated. And one thing I didn't explain before showing the example is in my translation data, I'm using a feminist approach. Feminist translation was established in Canada. And according to feminist translation, fidelity is not to be directed to the author or to the reader, but to the writing project. So here, the translator, it's a woman translating, so she's exercising the right to manipulate the text because according to her own feminist truth. Okay, and the last example I'm going to give you, again, it's related to the little Naboo. Sa mère était plus préoccupée, de faire bouillir la marmite que d'éducation. If I read the Russian one, ее мать просто не хватало времени ей заниматься. Her mother simply didn't have enough time to look after her. Here, this one is a little bit funny because it appears like the translator is trying to defend the mother. You know, the mother here wanted just to marry her girl because to alleviate her own poverty. But the Russian translation, maybe it's a mistranslation. Maybe she didn't want to insert that character in that way. But looking at the text itself, it's a way of somehow, you know, poking fun at the mother because she's busy trying to, you know, instead of educating the little Naboo. But the Russian translation is very it's interesting. So it's moving away from that. It's kind of defending her mother. But I don't know why. I've managed to find only one Russian translator who she's still alive. So hopefully I'm going to go to Moscow and interview and have more insight before finishing this article. So the key findings, if I go back to Spivak's notion of disappearance, I can see here the woman didn't disappear. What happened under socialism? What happened is that the woman, the character, if you want, they became hegemonic subjects. So the womanism or womanist idea, it's lost. So we could argue that her voice was silenced, you know, on Spivakian account. But the subaltern is still alive. but he's speaking in the Russian language, so you know, in a different language, but he's still there. So I don't agree with Spivak on that respect. So I think because if like I said before, I'm taking a feminist approach where manipulation is allowed as long as you do it in the name of feminist truth, so you can manipulate the language. But on the other hand, I have to also recognize that they were not translated as subjects of the old feminism. So in that respect, it doesn't have solidarity. So therefore, the implication would be, here I would like to quote Mohanty, because I think it's very relevant, that when we translate other women, we have to be we have to translate in a way that can help build that solidarity. And if I return to Spivak, notion of that double constitution, you know, again, we can see that the Soviet case offers a solution to that. So there's no disappearance as such. The woman is still there, is still alive, but he speaks as a Russian subject. And this is okay if we use a feminist approach.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Can you hear me? So I, too, will be speaking in English. first, I want to start off thanking everyone for being here. I especially want to thank the conference organizers for putting together this wonderful and very thought-provoking discussion about feminism across space and time. My name is Marius Kotter, and I am a PhD student in the Department of History at Yale University. And I am delighted to share a portion of my research with you all today, especially since a few weeks ago I defended the prospectus for my dissertation. So I'm excited to go off. Thank you. So I'm excited to go off into the field, quote unquote field, next year to undertake the full year of my dissertation research. But I've been working on a portion of my project that looks at the black international circulation of images and ideas about Togolese women in anti-colonial struggles. So the full context of the full scope of my project looks at Ewe speaking communities in both Ghana and Togo, but the portion of the research that I'm going to focus on today is thinking about Togo in particular. So I'm using an Ebony magazine editorial to illustrate how Togolese women cloth traders, an elite group of women cloth traders called the Nana Bans, became these iconic symbols of black feminist liberation in the 1960s. So before I dive into my research, I first want to give a very brief background on Togo so that we can all be better situated within both the geographical and historical context for this talk. So Togo today is a country of about 8 million people situated on the west coast of Africa. Yet the conceptualization of Togo as this coherent geographical entity that we know today did not begin until the late 1800s, when the Germans became the first colonial powers to occupy the region and named it German Togoland. So the area remained under German colonial occupation until World War I, when British and French colonial troops from their respective colonies in the Gold Coast and Dahomey invaded German Togoland, defeated the colonial troops there, and then divided the region amongst themselves as British Togoland and French Togoland, respectively. And then in 1956, the British colonial empire incorporated their portion of Togoland into the Gold Coast colony, which then goes on to gain independence in 1957 as the modern Republic of Ghana. So 4 years later, in 1960, Togo would gain its independence after a successful decolonization movement there. Now, scholars looking at Togo's decolonization have analyzed it from a variety of perspectives. Yet the role of women within the movement has been understudied, and there has been, to date, no comprehensive analysis of Togo's decolonization movement within the broader Black internationalist sphere, thinking about how it relates to Black nationalist movements in the 20th century. So these are the two main themes that my dissertation engages with. And to me, nothing really embodies these two themes of Black internationalism and Togolese women's activism during Togo's decolonization better than a 1963 Ebony editorial on a Togolese woman named Eunice Adabunu. So this is the opening of the editorial. So if you open the magazine, that's the first page you see. So Eunice Adabunu was a successful textile trader and politician who financed nationalist candidates during Togo's struggle for independence from France. She also served as the vice chairman of the Togolese Women's Union, and she was elected to the Municipal Council of Lomé, Togo's capital city, shortly after the country gained independence in 1960. So like many African women of her time period, bibliographic information on Eunice Adabunu is scarce. However, the interviews that I've conducted with Adabunu's family and her close colleagues, as well as information that I've gathered from the Ebony editorial, reveal that she began her career as a trader by selling basically household items in the market in the town of Kwalime, which straddles the border between contemporary Ghana and Togo, and served as a major site for the movement of people and goods in the speaking communities that lived in the region. By 1950, Adabunu had resettled in the poor city of Lomé, and she had transformed herself into one of the premier distributors of these much sought-after Dutch wax textiles. So Adabunu was amongst the first, this kind of iconic generation of cloth traders that would become known as the Nana Benz, and these women are very prominent in Togolese culture and popular memory of the decolonization movement, but also contemporary politics. So beginning in the 1950s, the Nana Benz built essentially a commercial empire in Togo by gaining exclusive rights to the wax pattern cloths that were produced by the United Africa Company and then later would become Vlisco for markets in West and Central Africa. So they had exclusive rights to be the only distributors of particular textile prints that were very popular. And in her 2016 monograph, anthropologist Nina Slavanis documents how the Nana Benz's trade empire turned Togo's largest market, known as Ashigame, into the center of textile distribution in much of West and Central Africa. So the wealth that the women accumulated from the textile trade allowed them to become the first people to import the Mercedes-Benz into Togo. And so the Mercedes-Benz becomes this really quintessential symbol of both the women's power and influence in the country, therefore granting them the name Nana Benz. So Eunice Adabunu leveraged her economic power as a Nana Benz to shape the political culture. Here's actually a picture of a group of women cloth traders in Togo. So Eunice Adabunu leveraged her economic power as a Nana Benz to shape the political culture of the Togolese independence movement. She frequently gave public speeches to her fellow traders in Ashigame about how Togo's decolonization and independence from France would benefit them specifically as women traders. And she also made financial contributions to the campaign of Slavanis Olympio, who was the leader of Togo's anti-colonial struggle and would go on to become Togo's first president. So the Ebony editorial claimed that Adabunu donated a pair of gold earrings and $400 to nationalist candidates. So $400 today would be $400 then today would be about 3,000 like 300. And although the full extent of her financial contributions to Slovanos Olympios' campaign remain unknown, in my interviews with her former colleagues, they indicated that in addition to her giving her own money to Slovanos Olympios' campaign and other nationalists, anti-colonial nationalists, Arabunu was also instrumental in organizing fundraising events specifically to support the project of decolonization. So the Ebony article on Arabunu is striking because it is one of the few written sources that illustrate the anti-colonial activism of Togolese women traders in the mid-20th century. Because most of these women did not read and write, there's a lack of written sources that detail their political experiences from their own perspectives. But despite this, the Ebony editorial highlights that the women's contributions were recognized and even celebrated internationally at the time of Togo's independence. So Ebony magazine's profile on Eunice Arabunu's economic and political success in Togo was an international expression of the magazine's larger commitment to highlighting the accomplishments of Black communities. The publisher and businessman John H. Johnson founded Ebony magazine in 1947 in response to what he perceived as people not talking about all the, quote, swell things that Black people can do and will accomplish, end quote. Explaining the editorial policy of Ebony in a 1968 Time magazine interview, Johnson remarked that, quote, essentially our policy is an inspirational one. We want to motivate those who are coming up in the world, end quote. For Johnson, it was essential that Ebony illustrate to its largely middle-class African-American audience that they too could overcome obstacles to, especially racialized obstacles, to their success in the United States. So like many Black magazines and newspapers in the mid-20th century, Ebony magazine provided its readers inspiration from abroad by highlighting the achievements of Black communities around the world. So the internationalization of Ebony's focus on inspiring its readers around the world, So the internationalization of Ebony's success on inspiring its readers resulted in considerable coverage of African decolonization movements in the mid-20th century. So I've included several images that illustrate these front page cover stories celebrating, like Henry Belafonte going to Egypt, the president of Guinea and coming to the U.S., and then several African delegates at the United Nations. So you can see this kind of internationalization of Ebony's magazine to inspire its Black readers with stories about the success of African decolonization movements. So Ebony's readers responded very enthusiastically to the success of anti-colonial movements in Africa, because for them, the success of decolonization movements on the continent offered a vision of freedom that proposed that they too could overcome racialized oppression in the United States, just as Africans were casting off the shackles of colonial domination. And so for them, the fight against white supremacy was seen as a global project. So this articulation of linkages between the political projects of Black people around the world is what many scholars have defined as Black internationalism. And as a framework of analysis, Black internationalism examines the political intentions behind both the formation as well as the articulation of solidarities between Black people around the world. And as historian Keisha Blaine and others have argued, people of color often formed and articulated these linkages in order to combat slavery, colonialism, and imperialism. So at first glance, the Ebony editorial on Eunice Arabunu then can be read within this, read simply as part of the magazine's larger focus on inspiring its largely Black audience with stories about successful decolonization movements from across the world. Yet the fact that Eunice Arabunu was a woman who was being presented as a nationalist leader demands a closer interrogation of the article. In fact, a close reading of both the rhetoric and the images in the text reveals that the profile of Eunice Arabunu is an expression of a gendered perception of Black liberation that placed Black women, and in this case, Black businesswomen, at the vanguard of Black nationalist movements. Although the editorial on Eunice Adabunu does not list an author, the story was probably written by the journalist, 5 minutes, by the journalist Arabelle Thompson. Thompson was the managing editor of Ebony Magazine during the time that the profile on Adabunu was published. And she was invited to Togo in 1960 to celebrate Togo's first independence. So born in Des Moines, Iowa in 1905, Thompson catapulted onto the American literary scene with the publication of her memoir, American Daughter, in 1946. And the success of American Daughter solidified her career as a writer and landed her a job with Ebony as an associate editor in 1947. And she worked there and worked her way to becoming managing editor of the magazine by 1963 when the editorial on Eunice Adabunu was published. So like Johnson, Arabelle Thompson also expressed this clear commitment to Black internationalism in her editorial decisions. Yet, despite her longstanding commitment to Black building solidarities between Africans and African Americans, her writing this editorial as simply an articulation of Black internationalism also obscures the explicitly gendered and capitalist nature of this editorial. So what is most striking about the ways that Adabunu is presented in this article is it's representing a Black woman as a leading figure in nationalist movements. And to be sure, women had previously appeared in the magazine's coverage of decolonization movements. So they would talk about the wives of like different African nationalist leaders. But these publications focus on things like the dresses that they wore to cocktail parties, like how they interacted with people, instead of any real interrogation of their political ideologies or anti-colonial activism in their countries. So then beyond just an expression of Black internationalism, then the editorial on Adabunu argues for a vision of liberation that placed Black women at the forefront of nationalist movements. So this form of Black internationalism is what Shira Hagashida has defined as Black internationalist feminism. But I want to go beyond that kind of characterization and argue that the representation of Eunice Adabunu as a successful entrepreneur also calls attention to an underexamined form of Black internationalist feminism. That is the belief that Black women's business ventures were essential for achieving Black liberation. And while studies on women, African-American women traders like Madam C.J. Walker have revealed that Black women's entrepreneurism were seen as essential for fighting white supremacy in the United States, more work remains to be done on how Black women in the U.S. drew inspiration from the entrepreneurism of Black women in other areas of the world. So since I have 2 minutes left, oh, great. The images and the text and the editorial and Eunice Adabunu worked together to offer a particular articulation of Black internationalist feminism that tied Black liberation to Black women's economic ingenuity. So many of the images that the editorial presented on Eunice Adabunu featured her in these different political situations, but they also made sure to explicitly illustrate her business activities. And I don't have those ones there, but I'll talk more about the pictures. So the photographs that were used in the 1963 editorial provided a visual narrative that worked to position Eunice Adabunu as a powerful political and economic actor. And in the last section of the editorial, which is titled "Trader is a Feminist Power," I think this is it, yeah. Features images that present Adabunu as a feminist who, quote, brings the same hard-driving, hardy methods to feminism, trading, and politics. And it characterizes her as a, quote, engaging combination of shrewdness, sharp humor, and aggressiveness, end quote. And the editorial explains that although Adabunu may, quote, intimidate mere men, to her country's astute male politicians, she is an invaluable asset representing money in the bank and votes in the bag, which is the title of the presentation. The description of Arabunu's personality seems designed for Ebony's women readers, advising them not to be afraid to be shrewd or aggressive, because although this behavior might intimidate mere men, their intelligent male counterparts, the smart ones, would recognize that they are an asset both politically and economically. And then the editorial goes on to explain how Arabunu's political activism, specifically within the context of the Togolese Women's Union, allowed her to travel to Pan-Africanist conferences in Russia, where she admired the indefatigable and equally strong-minded Soviet women, but that she scorned the high prices and the poor quality of Russian merchandise. And although it's not clear that these were actually were representative of her words, it illustrates Ebony's larger interest in making the story of Arabunu a celebration of capitalism explicitly and a rejection of communism, which was an important stance for the magazine to take in the context of the heightened fears about communism and the Cold War political landscape. So the focus on Arabunu's feminist activism in the last section of the editorial went along with images of her like riding bicycles and counting a large amount of cash in ashigame. And these images and the narrative presented in the editorial worked to illustrate Arabunu's political and economic power and the range of her activities in post-independence Togo. So by highlighting Arabunu's freedoms and her commitment to women's issues, Ebony magazine wanted to illustrate how instrumental women's economic and capitalist ventures can be for achieving Black liberation. It also aims to highlight the fact that Black liberation is essential for furthering Black women's political and economic rights. And as my work on the editorial Eunice Arabunu also aims to highlight, for some African-American women like Arabelle Thompson, who authored the story on Arabunu, capitalism was seen as an essential vehicle for achieving Black women's liberation. And as my dissertation unfolds, I hope to interrogate further how the context of the Cold War shaped discussions of capitalism amongst Black women around the world, and how the images of Togolese women in US editorials were being co-produced by both African American women and Togolese women. Thank you.
So we have, on a combien, 20 minutes? Okay, 15 minutes, donc trois questions. Oui, okay. Voilà.
Okay, I have one very short question to Amatula. Congratulations for your presentation and for your work. I have a methodological question for you. How did you get into contact with your women migrants women you met in Morocco? And how did you construct your relationship with them?
My methodology, how did I construct the relations? I don't know if you guys know who Moha Naji or Fatima Siddiqui is, but Fatima particularly writes a lot about Moroccan feminism and African feminism within the context of indigenous populations in Morocco. So I spoke to them and read a lot of their writings and kind of constructed with both of them, both on like the anthropological side with Fatima and the policy international affairs side with Moha, a set of questions. And then there is one church in Fez, and I went there every single day for 2 weeks, intended. And there was mass every Sunday, and there was two masses on the French-speaking and the English-speaking, and I just spoke to as many people as I could, trying to get in contact with very specifically women of those four intersectionalities. And I got my way in. It was very very nice, and very nice relations. We still talk. WhatsApp.
I wanted to, first of all, thank you all for your presentations. Et j'ai une question à poser à Sylvain. Sylvain, j'étais très frappé dans votre discours sur le langage employé par, utilisé par les employés en critiquant les ouvrières, les travailleuses de Boumidom, qui me rappelait beaucoup de langage employé par les maîtres d'esclaves dans une autre époque. Et je me demande s'il y avait... si c'était reconnu par les employeurs, mais certainement par les femmes ouvrières des Antilles. Et si on peut tracer un lien, surtout dans la perspective des femmes de Boumidom, des Antilles, entre le travail de Boumidom et l'histoire d'esclavage aux Antilles.
En effet, hein, sur l'esclavage, c'est pas un hasard s'il y a des... S'il y a la manière dont les personnes sont traitées peuvent sembler, les mots qui sont utilisés peuvent sembler similaires, donc c'est pas un hasard. Et moi j'ai pas trouvé de lettres de femmes, mais je suis pas tout seul à chercher sur ces archives, on est plusieurs à le faire, et on va peut-être trouver des lettres de femmes où il y en est question. Il y a des lettres d'hommes qui font référence à ça. Qui peuvent faire référence à l'esclavage, c'est-à-dire qu'en fait il y a des fois des lettres qui sont très en colère et dans ces cas-là l'institution est vraiment accusée et ça a été utilisé aussi en mai 68, le siège du Boumidom a été envahi et il a été tagué des références directes contre le Boumidom avec des références directes à l'esclavage, à la traite négrière, etc. Donc ça a été utilisé par les acteurs eux-mêmes, pas forcément les actrices, mais en tout cas les acteurs eux-mêmes à ce moment-là.
Merci pour les différentes présentations. Je suis Martin Ibok de l'Université de Douala au Cameroun. J'ai une question à l'endroit de Sylvain. C'est vrai qu'il a parlé de la division du travail. Est-ce que cette division sexuée des tâches n'a-t-elle pas été établie avec la complicité des femmes au regard des témoignages que vous avez évoqués? Merci.
Et sur la complicité des femmes dans la division du travail, je ne sais pas si on peut vraiment parler de complicité. En tout cas, elles n'avaient pas trop le choix. C'est-à-dire qu'elles étaient dirigées vers le centre de Cruis-sur-Ourcq et les hommes étaient dirigés vers les centres qui les formaient pour la métallurgie, pour les chantiers, tout ça. Et voilà, donc en fait, les deux seules destinées qui étaient imaginées pour elles, c'était surtout la domesticité et éventuellement travailler à l'hôpital. Mais il n'y avait pas d'autres destinées qui étaient envisagées par le Boumidom.
Ok, moi j'avais une question pour Monsieur Kasongo. Vous parlez un peu de la traduction russe de Mariam Aba, qui n'est pas si fidèle à la version française. Et vous l'attribuez à l'approche féministe utilisée par son auteur, à la traductrice. Alors, je me demandais un peu dans quelle mesure est-ce que cette traduction n'est pas aussi fidèle à la version française parce que le français lui-même pourrait être une traduction du Wolof de Mariam Aba. Je m'explique, dans le roman, des fois, elle utilise des expressions comme « le sang est retourné à sa source ». En anglais, on le traduit par « blood returned to its source ». Mais à un public qui n'est pas Wolof, qui ne vient pas du Sénégal, il n'y a pas de sens dans cela. Donc, dans une seule langue, on voit du français, mais est-ce qu'il se pourrait que ce soit un peu de la transposition linguistique? Et l'autre, ce n'est pas une question, mais l'autre coïncidence, c'est que demain, je présente aussi sur une seule langue. Je suis aussi francophone et je le fais en anglais. Et je me demande...
Ok, merci pour votre question. Je suis content que vous écriviez aussi en anglais. Donc, si vous voulez, on pourra continuer la conversation. C'est intéressant pour moi aussi. Transposition linguistique. En anglais, souvent, on appelle ça linguistic hybridity. C'est comme ça qu'on appelle ça en anglais. Et quand j'ai fait mon master, j'ai aussi écrit beaucoup sur ça. Parce que c'est... Vous avez absolument raison, ça pose problème dans la traduction. Et c'est ce qui rend la chose difficile, parce que la Russie n'a pas des liens historiques comme tels, comme la France avec l'Afrique. Donc, vous voyez, quand ils traduisaient, surtout en ce moment-là, vous pouvez imaginer la difficulté de la traductrice, quoi. Parce que il y a il y a un manque de connaissances approfondies bon, par rapport aux pays occidentaux. Mais en général, ces transpositions dont vous parlez posent problème dans la traduction. Et dans ma recherche, je suis en train d'adapter une méthodologie féministe pour la traduction de ce qu'on appelle en anglais linguistic hybridity. Parce que les écrivains comme Calixte Béala, quand ils écrivent, c'est la même chose. Vous allez trouver des expressions du Cameroun, de Ewondo, ou bien c'est vous sentez que non, ça c'est une métaphore en Wolof, mais elle écrit en français. Et c'est un français un peu, vous sentez que, voilà, c'est français mais pas français. Mais on doit traduire en anglais, on doit traduire en russe, et ça pose problème. Donc j'ai des livres, des recherches, des gens qui ont fait récemment, sur ça, mais parmi mes recherches, je n'ai vu personne qui s'est concentré sur le féminisme, parce que c'est par ça je veux dire traduire les femmes qui écrivent de cette façon-là, et c'est ce que je suis en train de faire en ce moment. Donc si vous voulez, je pourrais vous donner quelques détails et vous parler en plus de ma méthodologie que je suis en train de créer, d'adapter pour justement répondre à ce besoin de traduire les femmes tout en respectant cette transposition linguistique que vous avez appelée. Mais ça pose problème et il y a un débat sur ça, comment traduire. Et surtout qu'en ce moment, à cause de la mondialisation, nous parlons plusieurs langues. Tout le monde parle plusieurs langues, tout le monde écrit dans plusieurs langues. Et quand on se fait traduire, on doit traduire toutes ces langues-là. Merci.
Thank you for the panel. I want to ask the presenter on Nana Adabunu's part if she managed to query the role she played along other women, because she seems to tower above the other cloth merchants in Togo. And it is evident from what you have said, the deduction I made personally was that she didn't do it alone. So perhaps in the course of your dissertation, you could find out her contemporaries, those who were close to her at the market, and how they supported her and propelled her into economic and political limelight. Thank you.
Thank you for your question. That's a really great question. And I think part of what's happening here is that I'm focusing specifically on the editorial in Ebony that only covers one of the Nana bands that I know of, which is Eunice Adabunu. So that's why she takes up so much space in this particular presentation, is because this one is just focused on her. So my project looks at the first cohort, this iconic cohort of the Nana Benz, and there's about 30 of those women. In addition to that 30, there's several women that worked with them that didn't have the kind of economic power that the Nana Benz and the influence that the Nana Benz in particular had. So to answer your question, I'm looking about 30 women right now, but as the project moves on, I might reduce the number, just because in terms of like space and timing, a lot of these women have not left the same kinds of records that Eunice Adabunu has left, or other women. But I'll do a lot of work in oral histories of their family members, and I work a lot with some of the younger generation of Nana Benz, called the Nanettes, so that are daughters of these women who have since passed away. In total, the women that I'm looking at right now, there's about 30 of them. And Eunice Adabunu is actually considered the first Nana Benz, because she imported the first Mercedes into Togo. That's like the story. So she is a very prominent figure in the decolonization movement. So that's probably why she ends up in the Ebony editorial. But you're definitely right in saying that she did not do it alone, and she could not have done it alone. And there was definitely a lot of Nana Benz and other women traders who supported her initiative.
going to steal 30 seconds, and it's a comment for you, for your paper, something that I found very striking, and I think that will be worth looking into during your research, is the transposition in the bodies, the way the editorial is being set between this powerful, you know, mama, and then, on the other hand, the African-American model, and the way the bodies are being, I mean, I found that it was very striking, right?
And then in relation to your comment, I completely agree with that. And as you can see, I scratched out a lot of the different portions of the talk because I realized we only had 15 minutes. And so I didn't do a lot of the visual analysis that I do in the paper. And the visual analysis that I do includes not only the images of Eunice Adabunu in the editorial, but how those images are placed in relation to specific ads and how that placement process itself communicates certain ideas about which kind of bodies are embodying politics, which ones are embodying beauty, and the kinds of beauty, like light skin, skinnier women, yeah, exactly, skinnier women positioned next to Eunice Adabunu. And the Nana Bens are historically known for taking a lot of pride in being big women, and they show that through their clothing that exaggerates their features. Yeah, exactly. So I'm thinking a lot about that. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Alors, donc on va conclure maintenant et puis tu annonces les festivités pour demain.
Oui, on va revenir ici.
9h30, conférence d'ouverture, ni potomitan ni féministe, dilemme identitaire, modernité, nouvelle ontologie féminine en Guadeloupe au 21e siècle avec Stéphanie Mulot. Vous ne voulez pas louper ça.
Donc vous pourrez continuer vos discussions avec différentes participations. Et c'est le bâtiment de derrière pour ceux qui avaient le lunch avec nous.